from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Sabrina Merrill.
And I'm Nora Balin.
This week on War News Radio, strife in Syria.
First, we get background on what's been happening in Syria to date.
Next, we hear from two professors about the social dimensions of the Syrian conflict.
Then we present a Syria-themed version of our editorial segment, Filibusted.
After, we talk to a Syrian student about his perspective on the violence in Syria.
Finally, we discuss the challenges to eliminating Syria's chemical weapons arsenal.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Two 130 members of Iran's parliament produced a statement expressing their approval of Iranian President Hassan Rouhani's negotiation with the United Nations regarding the presence of nuclear weapons in the Middle East. While this diplomatic breakthrough was backed by the Iranian Assembly, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu expressed his skepticism by referring to the talks as a, quote, wolf in sheep's clothing. In response, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif blamed Netanyahu for hindering negotiations and expressed his desire to continue diplomatic talks.
Mojtaba Okhmadi, the commander of Iran's cyber warfare headquarters, was killed in an apparent assassination attempt in Karaj earlier this week. Iranian scientists have accused Israel's Mossad spy agency of ordering the attack, as eyewitness testimonies indicated that Okhmadi was shot by two men on a motorbike, a technique favored by Mossad in the past. Iran's Revolutionary Guard has begun to investigate the attack, though leaders hesitated to label it an assassination. The Guard, however, echoed the concerns of scientists about Mossad's involvement, comparing the murder to recent slayings of Iranians by Israeli forces.
At least 5 people were killed and hundreds were driven out of their homes after Buddhist mobs targeted Muslim villages and mosques near the coastal town of Thanwe in Myanmar this week. President U Thein Sein condemned the religious conflict and said that the sectarian violence, quote, tarnishes the national image internationally. Human rights activists and members of the United Nations, however, have questioned Sein's sincerity and accused him of encouraging the ethnic cleansing of Muslims in Myanmar. Violence against Muslims in the country is not a new phenomenon. While the Muslims targeted in the most recent attacks were members of the Kaman minority, violence against Rohingya Muslims has persisted for decades.
Satellite imagery released this week confirmed that North Korea restarted its nuclear reactor at the Yongbyon facility north of Pyongyang. While reports by United States research groups in early September suggested the potential for the reactor to someday become operational, the most recent photographs provide clear evidence that the reactor is now fully functional and capable of producing weapons-grade plutonium and uranium. North Korea announced plans to reinstate its nuclear program in April, and heightened activity at the Yongbyon facility has signaled its commitment to increasing its nuclear arsenal in the coming months.
The government crackdown on Greece's fascist Golden Dawn Party continued this week with the arrest of party leader Nikolaos Mihaloliakos on charges of founding and participating in a criminal organization. At least 24 other party members were also arrested. Every arrested member of the party has denied the 31 charges against them, including murder, extortion, blackmail, and money laundering. Parts of a government report leaked this week stated that Golden Dawn routinely sent out party supporters to attack immigrants. However, party sympathizers raised concerns about the way the government has conducted the investigation and claimed that much of the evidence against party members was obtained through unapproved wiretaps.
15 people died this week in a suicide car bombing in northwest Pakistan. The attack, carried out by the Pakistani Taliban, targeted rival militant commander Nabi Hanfi. Hanfi himself apparently suffered only minor injuries. After claiming responsibility for this most recent attack, Pakistani Taliban spokesman Shahidullah Shahid expressed the Taliban's continued determination to target Hanfi for his support of the Pakistani government.
A group of approximately 60 armed attackers descended on the Russian embassy in Libya earlier this week, following the alleged murder of a Libyan military officer by a Russian woman in Tripoli. While no members of the embassy staff were wounded, one gunman was killed and 4 more were injured. After the attack, the Russian Foreign Ministry evacuated the embassy and discouraged Russian citizens from traveling to Libya. This incident marked a dramatic shift away from the previously amicable relationship between Russia and Libya under the leadership of Muammar Gaddafi. A spokesperson for a Russian business council noted that the attacks came just before a planned conciliatory visit to Libya by a group of Russian companies and raised serious concerns about the future state of commercial relations between the two countries.
According to a report released by the United Nations this week, almost 1,000 individuals, including 92 soldiers and at least 887 civilians, were killed in Iraq during the month of September, and over 2,000 were injured. The report attributed the high number of casualties to increased sectarian violence perpetrated by Al-Qaeda insurgents in an attempt to renew conflict between Sunni and Shiite groups. The report came in the wake of a series of car bombings in Baghdad that killed over 55 people this week. The sharp rise in deaths in recent months has raised questions about the potential for escalated civil war between Sunnis and Shiites.
This is War News Radio. Over the past 2 years, an ongoing civil war in Syria has claimed the lives of over 100,000 civilians. War News Radio's Varun Prasad turns back the clock to look at the conflict's origins and its development over time.
In the past 2 years, the world's attention has become increasingly focused on Syria as a violent security crackdown escalated into a deadly civil war that has killed over 100,000 Syrians.
Civil unrest began with peaceful anti-government protests in March 2011. These protests, centered in the southern city Dara, called for the release of political prisoners and expressed the protesters' opposition to President Bashar al-Assad's regime.
The government security forces responded violently, firing live ammunition at protesters in Dara and killing multiple individuals. President Assad's regime also attempted to quell the protests by offering various concessions to the opposition.
April 2011, the Syrian government ramped up their attempts to suppress resistance, sending the Syrian army to areas where protests continued to occur, and arresting and torturing opposition members. By the end of May, over 1,000 had been killed in the conflict, and civilians had begun to flee to Turkey to escape the violence.
In July 2011, an umbrella opposition group named the Free Syrian Army was formed with the goal of ousting President Assad. The group primarily consisted of soldiers who had defected from the Syrian army. Several high-profile defections followed the announcement. That August, the Syrian National Council was created in an attempt to create unity among all anti-government parties. Headquartered in Istanbul, Turkey, it was originally comprised of several members living outside Syria. Parties represented included the exiled Syrian Muslim Brotherhood and Kurdish opposition leaders.
By September 2011, armed opposition insurgents from the Free Syrian Army had begun an active military campaign against the Syrian government. The first major conflict between the forces occurred in the city of Rastan in late September. At the same time, the Arab League suspended Syria's membership in response to the reprisal by Syrian government forces against protesters and rebel forces.
The conflict continued to increase in intensity and scope through the end of 2011, with particularly heavy fighting in the city of Homs. As the year 2012 began, protests were few and violence was widespread. This was also the point at which the United Nations became involved in negotiation efforts to quell the violence.
In March 2012, the Council approved a peace plan crafted by UN envoy Kofi Annan. The non-binding plan called for a ceasefire, which came into effect on April 14, 2012. Reports of both sides violating the ceasefire surfaced in early May.
However, the ceasefire came to a de facto end on May 25th when, according to eyewitness accounts, a group of pro-government civilians, known as Shahiba, entered the Hula village north of Homs and slaughtered 108 people. The Syrian government, however, alleges that Al-Qaeda was behind the attack. In response, several countries, including France, Germany, and the UK, expelled senior Syrian diplomats from their territories. The Free Syrian Army condemned the Syrian government and proclaimed that it would resume defensive operations. In response, Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, went on national television to state his intent to crush the opposition.
After the fighting in Damascus ceased, the battle shifted to the second largest city in Syria, Aleppo. The Free Syrian Army capture the southwest districts of the city in what was the first major offensive on July 19th. The conflict in Aleppo is notable for the participation of a large number of foreign militia from France, Iraq, and Libya against the government. The battle still continues, with clashes reported as recently as late September 2013.
The first major offensive in Damascus occurred in July 2012. Fighting between the Syrian military and rebel forces took place in several districts of the capital. A suicide attack on national security headquarters in Damascus led to the death of several prominent officials in the Assad administration, including Defense Minister Daoud Raja and Head of Intelligence Hisham Bakhtiar. However, the military soon countered the rebel offensive and declared Damascus free of rebels on July 23, 2012.
The international community also called upon the various rebel groups to organize under a single banner. The Syrian National Council was headquartered in Turkey and was only thinly associated with the rebel forces on the ground in Syria. In response, the National Council for Syrian Revolutionary and Opposition Forces, better known as the Syrian National Coalition, was formed in November 2012. The coalition comprises 60 seats that have been divided among the participants of the coalition.
The international community responded to the growing violence in Damascus and Aleppo in several ways. In August 2012, President Obama threatened severe action against Syria if the Assad administration used chemical weapons on its citizens. The UN General Assembly passed a resolution calling for President Assad to step down.
Rebel forces clashed with Syrian troops throughout the early part of 2013. The Syrian government allied itself with the Hezbollah, a militant group based in Lebanon, and the combined forces recaptured several important towns near the Syria-Lebanon border in April from the rebel forces. While the international community refrained from any sort of action during this period of time, US intelligence agencies contended in April that they had proof that chemical weapons were used at least twice by the Syrian government during the course of the war. The Obama administration then proposed to supply the rebels with arms amidst concerns about Islamist presence in the rebel forces. The EU also lifted the embargo on its arms trade to Syria.
As the debate over foreign intervention in the conflict intensified in the United States and the United Kingdom, a devastating attack near Damascus killed 1,400 people. The Syrian government and rebel forces accused each other of using chemical weapons. In August, United States Secretary of State John Kerry recommended foreign intervention in Syria while holding the Syrian government responsible for the Damascus attack. President Obama subsequently announced his intention to seek congressional approval for a U.S. intervention in Syria and was supported by Speaker John Boehner. However, on August 30th, the British Parliament voted against intervening in Syria, contrary to Prime Minister David Cameron's stance.
In September, however, President Assad announced his acceptance of a U.S.-Russia plan to stockpile and destroy Syria's chemical weapons over the course of 1 year. Experts from the UN Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, began their initial inspection towards the end of September. Finally, on September 25th, the Free Syrian Army broke all ties to the Syrian National Coalition, putting the unified Syrian opposition in disarray.
For War News Radio, this is Henry Zain.
For War News Radio, this is Varun Prasad.
This is War News Radio. War and violence never exist in a vacuum. Intrastate conflict often has far-reaching effects that extend outside a nation's borders. War News Radio's Dylan Okabe-Jowdat and Aaron True spoke to two experts on the complicated social ramifications of the Syrian civil war. Sabrina Merrill contributed research and helped with the editing for this piece.
For War News Radio, I'm Dylan Okabe-Jowdat. This week, I spoke with Professor Farha Ghanam, who draws on her experience living and working in neighboring Jordan and Egypt. Dr. Ghanam has devoted years to exploring the role of gender in the Middle East, as well as the way cities evolve through social and national change. It is my honor to welcome Professor Ghanam. Professor, it's a pleasure having you here today.
Thank you for having me.
You grew up and studied in Jordan. From your experience in the country, what kind of effect do you think the violence of the Syrian civil war is having on Jordanians? And how are the everyday existences of Jordanians being affected by the influx of Syrian refugees?
I was actually in Jordan this summer, and I noticed that everybody was talking about the conflict in Syria, and talking about it for all sorts of reasons. First, because there is a deep concern about the future of the country and the future of the region. And there is deep concern that the conflict could actually spill to Jordan, which is a very fragile country. It feels, you know, it's like hanging in the balance. So there is a lot of worry about that. But there is also a deep worry about the human atrocities and the human cost of the war. And what you see on the news is often emotionally devastating for people. So on the one hand, there are these worries that are very much felt on a daily basis by many Jordanians. You find that a lot of there is also in Jordan a little bit of a split, because not everybody is with one side. There are people who actually fundamentally support the regime in Syria and feel, you know, that the opposition is being very brutal and they're not really, you know, motivated by the good of the country. And there are other people who actually support very strongly the opposition. Not only that, but there are actually young men who are going from Jordan to fight with the opposition in Syria. And in the city where my family lives, which is like 30 kilometers north of Amman, even when I was there over like, you know, a month and a half, I heard at least 3 young men who were killed in Syria, and their families were mourning them and so on. So there is that connection. But I think Jordanians also have been deeply concerned and troubled by the huge number of refugees that have ended up in Jordan. On the one hand, you know, historically there were deep relationships between Syria and Jordan, and there are family relationships and, you know, identifications with music and language and food and so on. There are continuities between the two countries. But at the same time, having such a huge number, and, you know, people could say as many as 1 million refugees, Syrian refugees, are now in Jordan, has become the source of major tension in the country. First, because there is Jordan has been under a lot of economic and political pressure. So, for instance, unemployment rates are very high, prices are very high. People have been feeling very stressed economically. And when you have a huge number of people suddenly coming to the country, two things happen. There is competition over resources, which, of course, increases, you know, makes things worse in the eyes of people, but also there is scapegoating. So now, you know, every problem you could say, oh, it's because the Syrians are here. But I think, you know, if you look at what has been going on, there has been an increasing pressure on valuable resources in the country, from health to education, housing. So, you know, for instance, the cost of all of that has been increasing greatly. The wages are dropping down so quickly, because a Syrian, out of desperation, is willing to do, you know, hard work for a very little amount. Even Egyptian workers, who used to be paid very cheaply, can't compete now with the Syrian labor.
That was Professor Farha Ghanam, whose latest book, Live and Die Like a Man, Gender Dynamics in Urban Egypt, is published by Stanford University Press. For War News Radio, I'm Dylan Okabe Jowdat.
And now we hear from Aaron True.
For War News Radio, I'm Aaron True. With us in the studio is Professor Sarah Kistler, visiting professor of religious studies at Swarthmore College. Professor Kistler currently teaches world religions and the religion of Islam, and has devoted years to studying the way Islamic law shapes family structures in Middle Eastern society. Today, we will be discussing the role that religion has played in the Syrian civil war. It is an honor to have you with us today, Professor. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Obama recently gave a speech on Syria in which he mentioned the ancient sectarian differences as a cause for the violence. In your opinion, Professor, how much is the current violence in Syria motivated by these differences? And how have they come into play in terms of further polarizing the Syrian people?
Yeah, I think that speech got a fair amount of attention, and I think that was an unfortunate turn of phrase, and it's not really correct. It doesn't really make any sense to say that there are ancient sectarian differences. I don't think that's what's going on here at all. You know, it's people who've lived under a repressive dictatorship since 1970, 1971, who simply want their freedom and want a democratic government. Where it does come into play, as I mentioned, is that since 1970, the Assad family has been fostering sectarian difference, you know, and has been playing it up because it's been to their benefit and helped them stay in power and helped them keep control. So it's been exacerbated by the actions of the Assad family. And then, of course, once things start happening along sectarian lines, one group is oppressed because they're not Alawi, and then people start to define themselves in those terms. And so there's a greater sectarian identity than there was in, let's say, 1965 because of that. But it certainly isn't anything that's existed for centuries.
Would you say that an important part to take away from this discussion would be that there's a sense of Syrian national identity that maybe isn't portrayed as well in the sort of mass media attention that the crisis in Syria is currently getting?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, and it's actually quite remarkable that there is a Syrian national identity. You know, when you think about a country that's created out of colonialism, that really was in some ways created by the Ottoman Empire, then recreated again by the French, then, and people still manage to see themselves as Syrian because of their history, because of shared language and shared geography despite religious differences. And then to only have 3 years of democratically elected government before outside forces conspire to overthrow your democratically elected political system, and then 20 years of rather unstable rule, and, you know, now 43 years of dictatorship. And yet, you know, I've had discussions, and before the violence traveled to Syria and met with Alawis and met with Sunnis, and there's a real sense of Syrian national identity. And you even see that some of the groups, the internal groups who are fighting, often their name has to do with, you know, the Syrian Independence Party, the Syrian National Movement. It's not the Islamist this or the Shi'i this. And, you know, we only want to read so much into a name, but I think here it's really reflective of the fact that there is a Syrian national identity. The Syrian people were suffering, you know, but the vast majority of them have suffered for many decades under Assad's rule, and they're still generally fighting for a democratic regime. And the actual rhetoric on the ground, when you read what people are writing there, you listen to sort of internal radio programs, is not really sectarian or inflammatory. It's outside. It's Russia, and it's Iran, and it's Hezbollah, and it's the U.S., and it's these groups from North Africa we're talking about in sectarian terms, but not actually the Syrian people themselves.
So thank you so much, Professor Kessler, for coming in the studio with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
For War News Radio, I'm Aaron True.
This is War News Radio. Sometimes it's hard to read the news without getting angry. Caroline Batten and Sarah Morell have stopped trying. War News Radio proudly presents Filibusted, an editorial segment dedicated to news that makes us tear our hair out.
You'd be surprised how hard it is to make the conflicts in Syria seem funny,
since Bashar al-Assad isn't exactly a barrel of laughs.
Though, it is easier to laugh about it now, considering Syria has finally agreed to give up its chemical weapons, and U.S. invasion is no longer imminent.
France was the last one to get the message on that, though. Turns out French fighter jets were actually prepped for takeoff when President Obama called President François Hollande to cancel their bro date and announce the U.S. wasn't getting involved.
Hollande felt so proud to finally be invited to the foreign policy party that he didn't even realize Obama was changing his mind until the call actually occurred.
In fact, he was so sure Obama's phone call was going to confirm the airstrikes that he had his war team lined up to meet after the presidential chat.
Poor Hollande had to tell his posse that sadly they weren't going to get to be relevant in the international system today.
Considering France hasn't seen much action since World War II, this surprised absolutely no one.
But given the limited capability of France's weapons, France was only even going to attack a small handful of targets in western Syria. It was the US that was in charge of striking the rest of the country.
So France has to put its toys back in the toy box because the Syrian regime seems to be cooperating with international demands.
Syria has officially handed in the first part of its list of chemical weapons to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, and promises to fill in the remaining gaps by next week.
Because apparently, that's how the UN is keeping track of Syria's arsenal, asking Bashar al-Assad to just tell them what he's got in the cupboard.
And we can be completely sure that all the weapons are accounted for, and Assad isn't leaving any to show off to his other dictator buddies later.
It's always safe to trust a dictator accused of using sarin gas on his own citizens. He's definitely really keen to give up his warheads.
But the UN wants you all to know that no one is accusing Assad of anything. The UN Chemical Weapons Report makes a point of stating that they still can't say who used sarin gas in Syria.
They have the technical capabilities to tell us that the rockets were fired from Mount Qasun in Damascus, and to tell us where they landed down to the degree, but they're not allowed to have an opinion on who fired them.
Except that mountain where the rockets were launched? Yeah, it's got two kind of significant buildings on it. One is the presidential palace, and the other is a military base housing Assad's Republican Guard.
You're telling me that the rockets were launched right next to the presidential palace, in an area clearly controlled by Assad and his cronies, and the UN still has to leave open the possibility that it was the rebel forces?
Well, Assad's still saying they were fired by terrorists.
Yeah, terrorists camped out in his backyard.
Even though the UN report tried so hard not to piss anyone off, Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov was still quoted with saying that the UN inspectors compiled the report selectively and incompletely.
Okay, Russia, look. Here we have a UN report that categorically refuses to state that Bashar al-Assad's regime used chemical weapons, despite evidence that they were fired literally right next to the presidential palace. What exactly do you mean by selective?
You know what's actually selective? Russia carefully ignoring the fact that the sarin gas rockets fired on August 21st had Cyrillic writing on them.
Yup. Plus, it's now pretty much common knowledge that the majority of Bashar al-Assad's chemical arsenal comes directly from Russia.
So Russia is sending weapons to Syria. They just can't remember who they sold them to?
Right.
Speaking of the former Soviet Union, Russia and the US are currently working together about as well as they did during the Bay of Pigs fiasco.
So Russian President Vladimir Putin decided the best solution was to speak directly to the American people through a newspaper column in the New York Times. Frankly, he'd probably have a better chance of getting through to Americans if he wrote a BuzzFeed post, but it was still an enlightening article.
Putin emphasized that we should stop using the language of force and return to the path of civilized diplomatic and political settlement.
Wise words from a former KGB agent.
While he does have a point about America sticking its big patriotic nose into everyone's business whenever we feel like it,
the irony of his call for peaceful dialogue seems to have gone straight over his head.
Right. Because as we've already established, these are Russia's chemical weapons causing all the damage.
He's also got a pretty significant logical flaw here. First, he claims that we don't know that the chemical weapons were fired by Assad's regime. But then he says that the solution is to take away the chemical weapons belonging to the Assad regime.
Yeah, because that makes a ton of sense.
But in all seriousness, the hypocrisy of Putin's New York Times column is frightening. He says we shouldn't intervene in Syria because airstrikes would cause, quote, innocent deaths. Because clearly, none of the 115,000 Syrians dead in the crisis so far were innocent. Especially not the 6,000 children.
Look, there are a number of arguments on both sides of the intervention debate. But don't disrespect the casualties of this civil war like that. Seriously, Putin, you've been the leader of one of the largest nations in the world for the past 14 years. You should know better.
And the craziest thing? This is the man who just got nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize.
Yep. He was nominated this week by a Russian advocacy group called the International Academy of Spiritual Unity and Cooperation of Peoples of the World.
Because Vladimir Putin should be our standard for unity and cooperation.
He was clearly interested in international cooperation when he launched full-scale wars in Georgia and Chechnya.
And don't forget that this is the guy who supplies weapons not just to Bashar al-Assad, but to the government of Iran.
And now he might get a prize for promoting world peace.
I think I need some vodka to wash that one down.
Just make sure it's not Stoli, because Dan Savage seems convinced that you're supporting Russian domestic policy with every sip.
So how exactly is Putin trying to convince the international community that it was the rebels who launched the sarin gas rockets?
He must be working with solid and convincing evidence. Probably hiring top weapons experts. Or at least a scientist or two.
Actually, he's got an inside source.
And her name is Mother Superior Agnes Mariam de la Croix, a Catholic nun from the monastery of St. James the Mutilated in central Syria.
Seriously? A nun? From a monastery called the Mutilated?
Oh, it gets better. They're calling her the Detective Nun.
It's Agnes, Nun Detector.
The Detective Nun?
Nun Detector.
Basically, she's the Sherlock Holmes of the Catholic Church. Just, you know, minus the deductive reasoning and the scientific evidence.
She claims that the whole thing, all the evidence that the Assad regime was behind the attack, all the horrific scenes of civilians dying from sarin gas, was staged.
Mother Agnes claims to have done exhaustive analysis of the footage and says it's all been manipulated.
She brilliantly deduces that the videos must be faked because of the flagrant lack of real families in the footage.
Because, of course, your highest priority when documenting evidence of a war crime is arranging everyone into nice little family groups. For realism.
And Putin is using this as evidence against an actual UN report. Because clearly detective nuns and UN weapons inspectors have the same forensic skill set.
Well, after all, Putin does want to bring Orthodox clergy into the Russian government, so I guess he's sticking with the nun.
Because Jesus?
Or because no one with any actual skill was going to back him up on this one.
Preach. For Filibusted, I'm Sarah Morell.
And I'm Caroline Batten.
A big shout out to our hilarious producers this week, Will Sullivan and Tyler Welsh. They managed to get their stuff together even when the US government couldn't.
Thanks, guys. It's been a pleasure. At least for us.
This is War News Radio. Last year, Syrian high school student Mahmoud Halak moved to America to escape the conflict consuming his home country. War News Radio's Colin Smith talked to Halak about his experiences and his participation in the revolution, both in Syria and in the United States.
When I first met 17-year-old Mahmoud Halak, he described himself as a Syrian refugee. By all counts, he fit the definition. Halak came to America a year ago when he, his mother, and his sisters fled a rapidly deteriorating situation in their hometown of Aleppo.
Then we reached a point where a lot of people are getting killed every day because of the thousands of people in the streets. And it was the point where, like, Aleppo was officially in the revolution.
But leaving Aleppo was a difficult decision for Halak, who would become heavily involved in the uprising in Syria that would later move the country into civil war. It's a role that had a personal meaning for him, and one that he has continued since coming to the United States. While in Syria, Halak's involvement in revolutionary activities varied from making flags to warning protesters about police movements. Eventually, Halak himself took a leading role in organizing the protests.
I was one of the people who organized the places of the protests, choose the places, choose what streets we're going to take, when does it start, who's going to start it.
Joining the revolution was an easy choice, one that Halak had made before the revolution began. But as the conflict escalated, the violence touched those closest to Halak.
For me, I always supported the revolution, mm-hmm. always, all the time, even a long time before it started. But then my dad got killed by the government because of what he did.
Halleck's father was a prominent physician who ran an eating disorder clinic in Aleppo. In May of 2012, after returning from a business trip to America, Halleck's father was detained by government forces who questioned, tortured, and eventually killed him. His body was found in a ditch outside Aleppo a few days after his abduction.
At that point, it got personal. At that point, there's no more fear. We have a goal and we're going to do it, whatever it takes.
But ultimately, the situation became too dangerous for Halleck and his family, who moved to Turkey and then the United States, where Halleck now lives with his uncle. Initially, Halleck thought his days contributing to the revolution were over, until he started talking to his classmates at Lower Merion High School about his home.
But over time, I was like talking about Syria and my school, and I was surprised that some people don't actually know where Syria is or what's going on there. They have no idea about what's going on in the news. So at that point, I knew that I should do something to change that, at least change how people see Syria.
Halleck began looking for ways to raise awareness about the conflict that had consumed his country. A presentation he gave in front of 200 high school students was covered by the Philadelphia Inquirer, after which a number of other institutions wanted to hear what Halleck had to say.
At that point, I started getting more invitations from other high schools, synagogues, LaSalle University. They want me to go to their building and talk to their students or like their followers about Syria and what's going on there and tell my story. And at that point, I reached the point where like I feel like I can do something about it.
Halleck gave these talks to the backdrop of the changing situation in Syria. For Halleck, U.S. President Barack Obama's recent rhetoric about intervening in Syria to stop Assad's use of chemical weapons was a source of optimism, but also concern.
For a lot of Syrians, me including me, we saw like kind of hope that maybe something will happen now that will change the balance of powers there. So we kind of found hope. But at the same time, whenever America intervenes in the country, they don't go out until they get the best thing they want. So they were like, to what extent will American intervention be in Syria? When would they leave?
Ultimately, though, even if done alone, the route to a successful revolution would not be an easy one. The Free Syrian Army now must not only get rid of Assad, but also the new terrorist-connected groups that have joined the conflict.
Now, I think is taking Assad's of power will solve 50% of the problem. But after that, there's still a big fight between the Free Syrian Army and these extremist Islamists. The revolution ends. The Syrian people and the Free Syrian Army won't stop until they kick out these people from the country.
Although the process is long, Halleck is confident that the Syrian people are up to the task.
It's a result of 40 years of agony mm-hmm. and longing for freedom. The people wanted this for a long time, and they finally found the reason to start asking for it.
Halleck will continue his speaking engagements and has also begun writing articles in the Syrian conflict, continuing to communicate the struggle of his home nation to the residents of his new one. Though he may be a refugee, Halleck is still working to help the war-torn country he was forced to leave. For War News Radio, I'm Colin Smith.
This is War News Radio. This week, the international body responsible for finding and destroying chemical weapons in Syria begins its search. Backed by a UN Security Council resolution, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or OPCW, now has the substantial task of cleaning up Syria's WMDs by mid-2014, even as civil war continues. War News Radio's Amy DiPiero discovers why getting inspectors on the ground is just the beginning of the challenges ahead.
Discarding chemical weapons responsibly takes time and technical expertise. Iraq took the fastest route after the first Gulf War, pouring chemical agents into pits and lighting them on fire. But in Libya, a more cautious approach that started a decade ago still isn't finished. The U.S. Army's efforts to destroy our stockpile here at home are taking even longer and have cost some $35.4 billion so far, according to the New York Times. If history is any guide, inspectors from The Hague's OPCW team face a tall order as they enter Syria this month. But experts say that just getting the international community to work with Syria is opening up a window for regional diplomacy. I called up Chen Kane, she's a senior researcher studying weapons of mass destruction, at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies in Washington, D.C., to find out, really, what could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, let's talk about those obstacles. Where would you like to begin?
So the issue of destroying chemical weapons is not a simple issue.
Kane says the first challenge is just finding the stockpiles, especially since even the Assad regime might not know or control the places they've stashed the goods. That's assuming the government welcomes international inspectors in the first place.
If the regime does not cooperate, then they can hide things, they can smuggle things out of the country.
Jean-Paul Zonders is an unconventional weapons specialist who runs The Trench, a project investigating the meaning of disarmament today.
The biggest challenge I think we're going to face is, even if we assume that all the reported sites are under government control, as the Syrian government seems to be claiming, access to these places might have to go through rebel territory.
But let's say the Syrian government and various opposition groups cooperate. That would bring us to the next hurdle, resources.
They will need more people, they will need more money, they will need more experts, and also support of laboratory and analysis.
Kane says that right now, OPCW only has about 120 experienced inspectors worldwide. It's just not enough.
That will be insufficient to implement such an ambitious plan and very ambitious deadline.
So they're going on a kind of funding spree, appealing to nations and even individual donors to try to fill that gap. Russia and the United States, Kane adds, will probably chip in the most aid in additional experts and technology. The technology itself shouldn't be an obstacle. Lenny Siegel is the executive director of the Center for Public Environmental Oversight in Mountain View, California, a group which monitors chemical weapons cleanups in the United States.
What I've tried to argue is that the problems with destroying the weapons aren't technical.
Siegel says the technology to dispose of chemical agents exists, and some of it is portable enough to bring to Syria from the U.S. But he says the project could take longer than the mid-2014 deadline, depending on what inspectors find.
While the weapons could all be demilitarized within a year, there would be toxic waste streams that would need additional treatment.
Ridding Syria of chemical weapons, assuming security, resources, technology, and time are all available, will not bring peace. Zonders says many Syrians don't understand how the international community can ignore 100,000 civilian deaths, only to intervene for a few hundred at the hands of a poison. But he says shifting the conversation from a person, Assad, to a specific problem, chemical warfare, has helped some major players to negotiate.
It means that actually they can sit around the table to discuss an end to the hostilities, to discuss, perhaps a peace.
Many opposition groups, meanwhile, fear the chemical weapons deal will only entrench the current government. For War News Radio, I'm Amy DePiro.
That's our show for this week. War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College. Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Maggie Christ, Allison Raybar, Will Sullivan, Nitya Swaminathan, Chloe Wittenberg, Tyler Welsh, and Henry Zhang. Our piece editors are Caroline Batten, Sadie Rittman, Will Sullivan, and Chloe Wittenberg. I'm Sabrina Merrill.
And I'm Nora Balin. Until next time, thanks for listening.